Now, at this point, it is tantalizing to do all kinds of things and so many things which we don't have time for. One of our scholastics did a fine thesis on Maya and spent almost 2 years in trying to put into Western categories this very important concept. Now, the inner Hinduism, when it's faced with this wheel of existence, this eternity of reincarnations, as you would expect, they're not happy with it. And they say, or they hope, that there is a method of escaping the wheel of existence, provided a person comes to the realization that only Brahman exists and that all else is Maya. Let me repeat. According to Anicius, authentic Brahminism, this is Hinduism, as professed especially by the Brahmins, the intellectuals, now reflecting upon this wheel of existence which is so indigenous to popular Hinduism. They say that there is a way of escaping this wheel, of stopping this reincarnation. How do you do it? By your gradual, though it may take any number of existences to do it, they say it's worth it, to finally come to discover that Atman, that's the third, I said two, there are three important words.
That Atman is the Brahman, a perfect equation, sign between the two.
The point, therefore, at which a person discovers, notice it isn't a question of arriving at Brahman, but rather of discovering that Atman, which is self, you've got three important words, Brahman, which is absolute, Maya, which is illusion, Atman, which is self. The point at which it may take eons to achieve, a person, you see, you can't even speak of a person, because that's plurality. You imply there are individuals. The point at which Atman discovers Brahman, or if you wish, the point at which Brahman discovers self. That is destiny. Now, it's at that point, just to mention it here without dwelling on it, that Buddha was uncomfortable. And Buddha devised a whole new system to avoid the same thing, because he felt he didn't want to go on through endless reaches of eternal reincarnation. But he did not like the methods devised by the Hindus for escaping this wheel of existence. He tried all three, and there are three methods. We'll describe each in some detail and commend more to your reading and even years of further study. The three methods we referred to before have somehow already found in Gita. In other words, what I'm doing here is just elaborating as time goes on of what is already in the Vedic literature. The first is yoga, the second is karma, the third is bhakti, as we mentioned before. They may be very loosely described, yoga, as concentration and self-control through, of course, reflection. Karma as the unselfish performance of duty. And bhakti, that's spelled with a BH, as devotion and for contemplative love. Now, the two may go together, or the devotion may simply be another term for contemplative love. Something about each. Each is tantalizing, and if we only have a time, we'll spend a little, I hope, on Hindu spirituality. But there's much too much to discuss about their theology. First, the yoga method of achieving that discovery that Atman is Brahman. The yoga method has many stages. example, there are virtues to practice, there are rules to keep, there are postures to take, there is control of memory, control of mind, meditation. Each in successive stages, gradually more and more concentration, and though it may sound ridiculous to us, one of the most popular methods is concentrating on one's navel for as much as 8 hours a day. Finally, one reaches the stage of total absorption, which is called samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I, and to quote from a modern yogist, when the seer stands in his own nature. Now that language we hear, we know what the words mean individually, but the full import baffles us. When the seer stands in his own nature, you might say, in paraphrase, when he discovers what he is, well, that he is Brahman. The sattvic elements in yoga is the most important, yet bodily control is important as a means. And in fact, now there are a couple of books, and I think I have one in your bibliography, by, I think it's a Benedictine, on Christian yoga. And I'm not sure, but I think that in Thomas Merton's latest book on Zen Buddhism, have you seen it? You may have seen it advertised. I think it's got pictures in. I'm not sure. But I think it has a picture of the Jesuit general sitting in a yoga posture, praying. Well, that's a whole area by itself. Our Jesuit general is a very good Catholic. But there are elements in yoga that are profoundly important and useful. The relationship of body and spirit. And when I lecture, of course, I have a semester to do it because I just spread myself. When I was to teach my first class in Eastern religions at the university, it was 5 years ago, I was told not to be shocked when I faced my first class. So I braced myself, and it was well that I did. If you have collected the 30 most nondescript beatniks on campus. They were barefooted. Most of them hadn't shaved, the men, for maybe months. Women, unkempt. They never heard of a cutter or a hairdresser. But we got along famously. They were people who were searching, and when we talked about yoga, and the more I developed the merits of yoga, the more I could see that I was getting through. Some of them took it up. And several temples that I've got, which I've saved, on how they've discovered life in the practice of yoga, and they thanked me profusely for having led them to yoga. Well, one thing I did tell them, I didn't want them to become Hindus, but that there is a very close relationship, closer than most Westerners realize, between control of body and control of the spirit. And according to yoga, in fact, I'd say according to the best of common sense, you don't control the spirit without having all this baggage, you might say, of Hindu pantheism. See? You don't control the spirit. You don't get to the inner recesses of the spirit. You never get to know the spirit unless or until you have mastered that body. Now, there are all kinds of exercises. They start with very simple. They become more complicated. And by the way, the experience of pain is part of it. So that a person has such mastery of the body Of course, it cannot be such pain that would be positively harmful to the body. And there are degrees and varieties of pain, the pain that is essential to come to the inner spirit. And I'm told, for example, some of their postures are just impossible for us. See? And talking to one just recently, would spend 6 and 8 hours in excruciating pain, self-induced, to master the spirit. Maybe they can teach us a few things. We're not buying their theology and saying that. At any rate, the meditative phase follows after there has been some control of the body. And it begins with the fixation. This is the mental phase, fixing the mind on one object. And this is where the navel or the tip of the nose or the tip of the tongue stuck out. Now, psychologists, because you can imagine the amount of... You just let loose some of our American psychiatrists on this thing, and they just have a field day. See? Well, in many ways, they're wrong. They put it down to something which is pathological. They're searching. At any rate, one explanation, psychological explanation, of what happens is there is induced auto-suggestion. And I never thought of it when I did this, but my first thesis, and I've written a number since, was on hypnosis. And there's no doubt about it, that a person can, by just staring at an object with concentration, can hypnotize himself. And the state in which he is at that time, he is open to all sorts of suggestions. Effects on the personality, permanent effects on the personality. Now, they believe, and this of course is part of the yoga method, that once trance is induced, which is samadhi, and that's the Sanskrit for the trance, this is the culmination of the person who has discovered what or who he really is, namely Brahman. Now, there are all sorts of mixtures here. There are mutations and permutations. Buddhism came along and borrowed a good deal of this, then superimposed its own theology on top of yoga. So you name it, yoga has it. At any rate, at its simplest, and I hope somewhat clear, the yoga method is the method of concentration, first of the body, then of the spirit. And that very concentration, the word, that inner syllable, chentrum, or the C-E-N-T-R root, which, by the way, is Sanskrit. See? The inner reality, the thing which is, that alone which is, the reflection on that, the coming to that, for all else becomes not only irrelevant, but non-existent. The karma method. This is chosen in preference to the yoga, especially for those who find it, as they soon find out, that yoga is difficult. This may be described in general as the method of service. So if you would call yoga the method of meditation, well, remember, meditation does not mean, in our Christian sense, of prayer to a transcendent being. Karma, then, would be service. Or, if you wish, good works. It is chosen by many cultured Hindus who either cannot or prefer not to practice yoga. Its concentration is on works of charity and social welfare. It was the principal method used by Gandhi. In fact, Gandhi, who was a professed Hindu, believed that he was reaching his destiny. Which, you see, destiny has not got the same eschatology that ours has by the practice of karma. This was his driving motive. This is what finally brought even his death. As you know, he was assassinated for his love of his fellow man. He was especially the motive that he used to sell, as it were, Hinduism, or the practice, because after all, there are good Hindus and poor Hindus, as there are good Christians and poor Christians. Some who read about this or hear about it and couldn't care less, and others who put it into practice. Well, Gandhi might well be described as the greatest Hindu revivalist in modern times. And while the terminal effect of his revivalism had a lot to do with the future of India, in fact, the future of Eastern civilization, yet, and this is well to know, Hindus' motivating drive was not either to drive England out of India or liberate his country or get more social justice for his people. No. It was for himself, as he admitted, that he would achieve that destiny which he believed he had in store for him by practicing karma. It was also the motive that he used in encouraging his fellow Hindus to be better Hindus, to love their fellow man. And he had, as we too have, he had his pariahs, we have ours. Now, the pariahs in India, nobody knows the exact number, some say up to 100 million. They are, and we still have the caste system, which we're going to come to, that we're not going to come to today. They are the fifth group outside of all castes. In fact, pariah is the Sanskrit for outcast, where you spell outcast with an E at the end. In fact, our English outcast is a misspelling, which of course has now become a commonplace. It means out of all castes, beyond all castes. These people, as we will briefly talk about afterwards, were those who must have, that we can attribute their misconduct to them, have been very bad in their previous existence. Look how badly off they are. Well, Gandhi hit upon, and this of course is the peculiar combination of Gandhi as a mixture of Hinduism, Jainism, Islam, and especially Christianity. He carried the imitation of Christ with him wherever he went, because it was somewhat inconsistent with Hinduism that he should be so concerned about alleviating his fellow man. Yet he sensed, and he found in the Sermon on the Mount, and in Christ's famous prediction, you know, the 25th chapter of Matthew, on loving others as the condition for salvation, he told his people how familiar the whole world, east and west, believes the same. Man reaches his destiny by doing good to others. Of course, the destiny is different, though Gandhi had been quite Christianized by that time. The third method, and even if I go over a few minutes, shall we finish it so that we don't overlap with this part of our lectures? The first method, therefore, of yoga, which corresponds to concentration and the attempt to finally discover that center of reality, which is Brahman, karma, which is the doing of good deeds in terms of serving others, and finally, bhakti, B-H-A-K-T-I. Now, it need not, and for many pious Hindus, it does not differ radically from either the more difficult yoga or the more common karma. In other words, a person who practices bhakti may also practice the others, and he's encouraged to. However, if does have something to do with yoga in terms of the mind, because there must be some substratum for this devotion which bhakti is, and it will cost in terms of self-sacrifice, because a person cannot for very long practice this loving devotion to Brahman without having practice or having to practice some loving devotion to a lot of other people, if you want to call them people. Except you see the motive that he has in seeing Brahman as not only in all others, as being all others. There are two types of bhakti, as there are also two types of both yoga and karma, and I don't want to keep repeating the distinction. There is the monistic and the theistic. The latter is in a small minority. The majority of those who practice bhakti are monistic type. Just to insert a parenthesis, most converts among intellectual Hindus come from those who practice karma and especially from those who practice bhakti. In fact, most of the vocabulary of both karma and bhakti has been taken over lock, stock, and barrel by Christians and just given Christian terms with, of course, a Christian meaning. In the majority of cases, the object of devotion is not God in the absolute sense, but a God, the highest that this individual Hindu can imagine or conceive. Now the contradictions by our standards, the irreconciliations by Hindu standards. This deity is conceived as transcendent and yet subject to change. Now he must be considered as transcendent, otherwise why practice a loving devotion to him? Why praise him? Why worship him? Why offer sacrifice? Let me read just a line or two. To Agni, one of the many deities in the Veda, I praise Agni, God, minister of sacrifice. Worthy is Agni to be praised by living as by ancient seers. Through Agni, man obtains wealth, yes, plenty, waxing day by day, most rich. So, he must be conceived as transcendent, otherwise you don't worship him. Yet at the same time, he is subject to change. And prayer, therefore, directed to these gods, or this god, the one of one's choosing, does frankly intend to change the mind of the god. He is identified with self, yet above self. Now, I would say in general, if he is identified with self, it would be monistic. When he is above self, it is theistic. He is above man, yet he is one of whom man is a part. In some cases, some of the most beautiful among the Hindu mystics, natural mystics, conceive Brahman as a real personal deity, creator of the world, infinite, in whom Hinduism has at times reached mystic heights. And the prophetic yearning, Gandhi was one such, because he practiced bhakti, though his stress was on karma. The prophetic yearning in Hindu mystic writers for the incarnate God in human form, which is only partially satisfied in their avatars, and this is another, you have built up a vocabulary of about 100 words. In Hinduism, that should be known. Avatar is one. A-V-A-T-A-R-S, or the Sanskrit avataros, which means the descent, the coming down, in symbolic language, of one of these deities, and ultimately Brahman, to take on human form, live among men, share their sufferings, and thereby lead them back to himself. Often when you reach the highest reaches of bhakti mysticism, you were already in post-Christian Hinduism, and becomes difficult for the scholar to distinguish where Hinduism has left off and Christianity has been influential. That's why, as I tell my students, and I've told people who are even professionally in this field, one of the most important things for anyone to teach or to study Oriental religions is to know the dates, the origins of these ideas. Because Hinduism is a growing thing. It's constantly developing, and for almost two millennia, it has coexisted with Christianity, and has also, in large measure, coexisted with Islam. And as a consequence, to make sure that what we are talking about is authentic pre-Christian and pre-Islamic Hinduism, such scholarship as it is at my disposal, I have tried to give you, and will for the best of what we take of Hinduism.
This concludes Father Hardin's conference on the basic principles of Hinduism. On the next tape, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, morality and conduct of Hinduism.